In 1932, Bernard Lukács, president of the World Jewish League, said, "Germany is our public enemy number one. It is our object to declare war without mercy against her." In March of 1933, before the Germans had enacted any anti-Jewish laws and before any hostilities against the Jews had taken place, worldwide Jewish leaders officially issued a declaration of war against Germany. A worldwide Jewish boycott of German goods began. 20,000 Jews protested at New York City Hall. Rallies and boycotts were directed against German goods. Samuel Untermeyer, speaking on behalf of international Jewry, declared war on Germany with an economic boycott. The front page of the March 24th London Daily Express carried the headline, "Judea declares war on Germany." Jewish leaders were quoted as calling for a holy war against the German people. The Jewish wholesaler will quit his house, the banker his stock exchange, the merchant his business, and the beggar his humble hut in order to join the holy war against Hitler's people. The Express said that Germany was now confronted with an international boycott of its trade, its finances, and its industry in London, New York, Paris, and Warsaw. Jewish businessmen are united to go on an economic crusade. In August of 1933, Samuel Untermeyer talked about a planned annihilation and extermination of Jews underway, and also about a war that must be waged against Germany to stop it. In a hysterical radio broadcast, Untermeyer called for the Jews to destroy Germany in a sacred war, denouncing the Germans as cruel, savage beasts and ingrates. Untermeyer claimed that the Germans were annihilating the Jews by locking them up in vile concentration camps, starving and torturing them, murdering and beating them without cause, and resorting to every other conceivable form of torture, inhuman beyond conception, until suicide had become their only means of escape, and all solely because they are or their remote ancestors were Jews. This was 1933, and Untermeyer was already talking about a Holocaust. Well, he must have had some supernatural mental powers. In a radio broadcast on WABC New York, August 6, 1933, Untermeyer stated that each of you, Jew and Gentile alike, who is not already enlisted in this holy war, should do so now and here. It is not sufficient that you should buy no goods made in Germany. You must refuse to deal with any merchant or shopkeeper who sell any German-made goods or who patronizes German ships or shipping. We will undermine the Hitler regime and bring the German people to their senses by destroying their export trade on which their very existence depends.
The boycott of all German goods and services is our only remedy. We've now most reluctantly embarked upon a worldwide boycott in which we demand and are receiving the wide support of men and women of all creeds and classes. In all the ages, no more holy war was ever waged. In order to do their share of service, this army of civilization, you have only to buy and use, or to refuse to buy and use, any goods made in Germany, or to patronize German ships or shipping."
The new Germany that would break free from Jewish supremacism was declared to be an enemy of Jewish interest and thus needed to be economically strangled again. It is also important to note that this was before Hitler decided to boycott Jewish goods. Many Jews in Germany and Palestine opposed the international boycott, saying that it would promote anti-Jewish violence within Germany. These Jews supported the National Socialist regime, but the Jewish supremacists did not care at all. Despite efforts by the German government to alleviate tensions and prevent the escalation of name-calling and threats by the international Jewish leadership, it continued. The intensity of the Jewish campaign against Germany was such that Hitler stated that if the campaign did not stop, there would be a one-day boycott in Germany of Jewish-owned stores. Despite this, the hate campaign continued, forcing Germany to take defensive measures that created a situation wherein Jews became more and more ostracized. In a similar vein, the Jewish newspaper Natasha Rech wrote, "The war against Germany will be waged by all Jewish communities, conferences, congresses, by every individual Jew. Thereby that war against Germany will be ideologically enlivened and promote our interest, which require that Germany be wholly destroyed. The danger for us Jews lies in the whole German people, in Germany as a whole as well as individually. It must be rendered harmless for all time. In this war, we Jews have to participate, and this with all the strength and might we have at our disposal." Worldwide Jewish leadership, with an iron grip of world media and press, was now starting the massive launch of propaganda against Germany that soon would escalate into World War II. It was in direct response to this that the German government finally initiated a one-day boycott of the Jewish businesses after the Jews had declared war on Germany. Dr. Joseph Goebbels announced that the one-day boycott would be lifted if anti-German protests were suspended. If the protests did not end, Goebbels warned that the anti-Jewish boycott would be resumed. However, this would not help. The worldwide Jewish boycott continued for months. Vladimir Jabotinsky, which was a Jewish communist and a founder of the Irgun terrorist organization, wrote in the January 1934 issue of Natasha Rech, "The fight against Germany has been carried on for months by every Jewish community, conferences, congress, trade organization, by every Jew in the world. There is reason to believe that our part in the struggle will be of general value. We shall let loose a spiritual and material war of the whole world against Germany. Germany's ambition is to become a great nation again, to reconquer her lost territories and colonies. Our Jewish interests, on the other hand, demand the complete destruction of Germany. The German nation is collectively and individually a danger to us." David A. Brown, national chairman of the United Jewish Campaign, 1934, said, "We Jews are going to bring a war on Germany." Chaim Weizmann, president of both the International Jewish Agency and of the World Zionist Organization, and later Israel's first president, stated in 1936, "It is no exaggeration to say that 6 million Jews are sentenced to be imprisoned in this part of the world, where they are unwanted, and for whom the countries are divided into those where they are unwanted and those where they are not admitted." Emil Ludwig Cohn, in 1938, said, "Hitler does not want war, but he will be forced to it. And in fact, soon, England has the final say, like in 1914. Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, Hearst Press, September 1933, said, "War in Europe in 1934 was inevitable." In 1938, the Jewish declaration of war against Germany was repeated. The American people were urged by the Jewish-owned press to boycott all German goods and German businesses. At the 1936 World Zionist Conference, Chaim Weizmann said, "Perhaps only 2 million will survive the upcoming Holocaust, but they will be ready for life in Palestine." Note that this was in 1936. A letter published by the Miami News on 12th July 1938, entitled "Kill Off the Germans," stated that "nothing but the almost complete extermination of the savage whites will ensure peace on earth and goodwill toward men." Jewish professor Alexander Kulischer, noted lawyer and Zionist, said on October 1937, "Germany is the enemy of Judaism and must be pursued with deadly hatred. The goal of Judaism of today is a merciless campaign against all German peoples and the complete destruction of the nation. We demand a complete blockade of trade, importation of raw materials stopped, and retaliation towards every German woman and child." Germany's response was a defensive, not an offensive measure.
סיפורים חשובים, עובדות חשובות, שמעבירות דברים שלא קיבלנו בבית הספר. לא קיבלנו בתוכנית הלימודים, כשם שלא לימדו אותנו גם בחינוך גבוה. נתתי הרצאות לפני מורות ומורים להיסטוריה. למה באמת היטלר היה נגד היהודים? מה הוא רצה מהם? מה הפריעו לו? אבל הדברים כתובים כאן במיין קאמפף. זה הספר יצא רק לאחרונה, התירו לתרגם מיין קאמפף בעברית, זה אסור כל השנים. אבל יש לי תרגום קודם יותר שיד ושם תרגם קטעים, להם היה מותר. היטלר טוען בספר שלו שהיהודים הם קומוניסטים. הם עשו את המהפכה ברוסיה. הם הרגו שם 30 מיליון רוסים, את כל האינטליגנציה, בצורה אכזרית ונוראה. ואת זה הם רוצים לעשות לכל העולם. הארץ הבאה בתור זה גרמניה. הם הקימו את המפלגה הקומוניסטית והסוציאליסטית הגרמנית, וזה נכון. אם אנחנו לא נתגבר אליהם עכשיו, הם יחסלו אותנו, וישחטו גם כאן 20 מיליון איש את כל האינטליגנציה. וכך הם הלכו מארץ לארץ. כשבסופו של דבר האינטליגנטים היחידים, החכמים היחידים, יהיו רק היהודים. והוא צודק. את המהפכה ברוסיה עשו היהודים. את הצבא הרוסי בנה טרוצקי. הוא הקים את היבססט כהבריה, המחלגה היהודית של המפלגה הקומוניסטית. בתמונה של פוליט ביורו הראשון, זה כמו הממשלה ברוסיה, מתוך 13 חברים, 6 יהודים. מי הקים את הקגבה? לפני כן קראו לו אין כבודה. יהודים? אם כן, הדברים טובים מפורש. הוא לא שנא את היהודים בגלל שיש להם פאות. הוא לא שנא אותם בגלל שהם שומרים מצוות. בגלל שהם קומוניסטים. והוא כותב אותם בצורה ברורה. היהודים הרסו את הדת ואת האמונה. הם הפיצו בגרמניה את התפירה באלוקים. את זה הוא כותב כאן. אתם מבינים עכשיו למה הם לומדים את זה בית ספר? כי מי כותב את תוכניות הלימודים? אתם שמאלנים. הרסו את כל הערכים. הרעילו את כל הספרות והתיאטרון. מתוך 9 עיתונים גדולים בגרמניה, 7 היו של יהודים.
Aber da bin ich noch nicht am Ende in meinem Denken. Warum dieses Geschehen oder dieser Gegensatz Juden, Deutsche so stark? Und warum dieser Hass der Juden? Warum musste das geschehen? Das ist mir noch völlig unklar. Aber vielleicht schaffe ich das noch.
Der Hass der Juden auf die Deutschen?
Ja. Weil ich habe noch nie von irgendeinem anderen Volk so hasserfüllte Äußerungen über ein drittes Volk gelesen wie bei den Juden. Warum?
Der größer war als der Hass der Deutschen auf die Juden?
Ja, der ist viel später, der Hass der Deutschen. Die Juden sind viel früher. Und Sie brauchen ja nur den Talmud zu lesen. Da habe ich ja alle 12 Bände in der autorisierten letzten Übersetzung und Ausgabe 2002. Weil wir die kursierenden Aussagen aus dem Talmud prüfen wollten, ob die stimmen. Und vor allen Dingen mit einer autorisierten Ausgabe. Und also ich kann das nicht mehr als 3 Seiten lesen, dann wird mir übel. So widerlich ist das, was da auch über Sexualität und so weiter alles drinsteht, dass man schon mit einem 3-jährigen Kind das machen kann und. Wissen Sie, das ist so uns fremd. Da will ich mich auch nicht reindenken.
From 1923 to 1933, German nationalists were regularly targeted by Jewish communists and terrorists. 200 National Socialists and 216 police officials were murdered by mainly Jewish communists. 20,000 National Socialists and 1,976 police officers were injured. Herbert Norkus, a schoolboy and member of the Hitler Youth, was brutally stabbed in 6 places. Horst Wessel, a young German student, was shot. The Swiss National Socialist leader Wilhelm Gustloff was brutally murdered by the Jew David Frankfurter in 1936. Germans were outraged at the murders. The acts of terror against the German people went on for many years without an end. February 27, 1933, 4 weeks after Hitler's appointment as Chancellor, communist terrorists set fire to the Reichstag.
local police catched a Dutch communist named Marinus van der Lubbe, the man who set fire to the Reichstag. The fire was to have been the start of a Red-instigated civil war before Hitler and NSDAP could establish themselves. Hindenburg and Hitler acted fast, issued emergency decrees, and communist leaders were arrested and sent to what later would be called concentration camps. Most of the communists were Jews. This is why media portrays it as a systematic persecution against the Jews. The Night of the Long Knives, also known as Operation Hummingbird, occurred in National Socialist Germany between June 30 and July 2, 1934. At least 85 individuals were executed and more than 1,000 arrested by the National Socialists. The reason for this was that SA leader Ernst Röhm and others were planning a coup against the Germans. The actions by Hitler was to prevent another communist revolution taking place in Germany. The purge strengthened and consolidated the support of the army leaders for Hitler. On November 9, 1938, a Polish Jew named Herschel Greenspan reached the German embassy asking to speak to a member of the diplomatic staff. When Ernst von Raff, a 29-year-old German diplomat positioned in Paris, came to greet the visitor, Greenspan picked up his pistol and murdered him in cold blood. This was the straw that broke the camel's back. The Germans now had enough of Jewish-inspired boycotts, slanders, warmongering, and murders aimed at them. The news of the murder triggered riots, torching, and vandalism directed at Jewish and communist shops and businesses. The riots were not sanctioned by any official NSDAP member, and it was an angry Goebbels who ordered the violence to stop instantly, and it stopped after the first night. Goebbels was at the time negotiating to overturn the international Jewish embargo and feared that the violence would derail the talks. Early in the morning following the Kristallnacht events, Goebbels announced in a radio broadcast that any action against Jews was strictly prohibited and warned of severe penalties for disobeying this order. He complained that he would now have to explain this terrible affair to the German people and the world, and that he simply did not know what kind of credible explanation to give. Hitler was also furious when he first heard about it and ordered the telex message to be sent to Galatiet offices, which read, "By express order from the very highest authority, arson against Jewish businesses or other property must in no case and under no circumstances take place." Several people were also arrested for violence against Jews. The Night of Violence, referred to by Jews as Kristallnacht, Night of the Broken Glass, is often mentioned in Western media and in our school books as crazy, spontaneous, anti-Semitic riots. But the repeated terror, psychological warfare, agitation, boycotts, and murders, which actually provoked German resentment, are never, ever mentioned in our history books. After the Jewish declaration of war on Germany in 1933, German officials compromised and made a deal in secret negotiations with the Palestine Center of the World Zionist Organization, which would allow German Jews and their assets to go to Palestine. That deal was called the Transfer Agreement, or the Havara Agreement. This pact enabled thousands of Jews to migrate to Palestine with their wealth intact. The immigration was a lawfully conducted and regulated matter, and not some kind of wild flight. It was an attempt to peacefully resolve the conflicts between the Jews and the Germans so that they both could live in peace again. Each Jew destined for Palestine deposited money in a special account in Germany. The money was then used to buy German-made agricultural tools, building materials, pumps, and fertilizers, etc., which were exported to Palestine and sold there by the Jewish-owned Havara Company in Tel Aviv. Money from the sale was then given to the Jewish emigrant upon his arrival in Palestine in an amount corresponding to his deposit in Germany. The agreement thus served the Zionist aim of bringing the Jewish people and assets to Palestine while simultaneously serving the German goal of reducing Jewish influence in Germany. Thus, Hitler supported the Jewish emigration to Palestine and Eastern countries from 1933 until 1941. When the war prevented further collaboration. By the time World War II broke out, Israel's economy would have $500 billion worth of assets shipped from Germany via the Havara Agreement. Meanwhile, in the US, the years between 1929 In 1939, 2 million Mexicans were also deported to Mexico, as first authorized by President Herbert Hoover. Of those, 1.2 million actually were born American citizens. Hitler's final solution to the Jewish problem was creating a homeland for the Jews on the beautiful island of Madagascar off the coast of southern Africa and resettle 1 million Jews per year under German protection and supervision. The idea of a Jewish homeland in Madagascar had actually been circulated throughout Europe since the 1880s. The National Socialists worked out a plan going into detail for the evacuation of the Jews to Madagascar and for the settlement there. SS Major General Heydrich submitted this plan directly to the Reich Foreign Minister in August 1940. The Madagascar plan was unfortunately scrapped when the British invaded the island in 1942, taking control away from the Vichy France after the Battle of Madagascar. A Jewish Madagascar would have been a win-win solution for Jews and Europeans, and would have spared the poor Palestinians and other Arab nations all of the horrors and wars they would endure after the founding of Israel in 1948. For centuries, Europeans and Jews have had problems living together. The Jews have been expelled from over 100 nations before. This expulsion was not something new. Every single nation where the Jews were given full rights and privileges, they had exploited and morally corrupted the host nation, defiled the Gentiles, and then created uproars against themselves. The Jewish supremacists have of course always been able to put a blame on quote-unquote anti-Semitism. The National Socialists want the Jews to leave Germany, and the Zionists wanted the Jews to come to Palestine to help create the Zionist state. The National Socialists held a conference in Wannsee, one of the suburbs of Berlin, on 20th January 1942, where it was decided on the final solution of the Jewish problem. The original document from the meeting is actually available on the internet, and nowhere does it say anything about killing the Jews. The meeting discussed neither gas chambers, shootings, nor any of other extermination methods.
There was never a final solution plan. That's one of the falsehoods that floats around. Just because the Nazis had used the term final solution, both in the years before the war and at the beginning of the war, that doesn't mean they ever actually drafted a plan. Even the minutes of the meeting, the minutes that were taken of the Wannsee conference, quite clearly state that the Jews at one point will be released. So there was no talk of any final solution plan there. There was simply a talk of, well, now that the Eastern Front is kind of stalled, we've got to figure out what to do with these many millions of Jews that we now have in our custody. That was a problem the Nazis did feel the need to deal with, but not by creating one giant overreaching plan.
The purpose of the Wannsee Conference was to discuss and plan how Europe's Jews would be deported to the East. Some Jews would remain in Germany to work with road and construction and more. They also decided that Jews who participated in the First World War, all of which were over 65 years old, and all who worked in the industries, would remain in Germany. This has also been confirmed by Yehuda Bauer, professor of Holocaust studies in Avraham Harman Institute of Contemporary Jewry in Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Transit camps were also created in Poland to facilitate the immigration of Jews. The term Endlösung der Judenfrage, final solution of the Jewish question, was a phrase used by the National Socialists regarding the Auswanderung, emigration, and Evakuierung, evacuation of Jews in occupied Europe to the East, Palestine, and Madagascar. The first to use the term, however, were actually the Zionists. The final solution of the Jewish question is in fact a direct quote from the 1897 Zionist Manifesto. The infamous phrase was being used by leading Zionists long before NSDAP even existed. In 1897, the National Jewish Association, Cologne, published its program called Thesis. Experience has shown that civic emancipation has fallen short of securing the social and cultural future of the Jewish people. The final solution of the Jewish question lies therefore in the establishment of the Jewish state. In 1897, the Rothschild founded the Zionist Congress and arranged its first meeting in Munich. This was rearranged in Basel Switzerland. This gathering was led by the father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, and in 1899 he proposed the final solution of the Jewish question and proposed liquidation of Jewish wealth. It is essential that the suffering of Jews become worse. This will assist us in the realization of our plans. I have an excellent idea. I shall induce anti-Semites to liquidate Jewish wealth. The anti-Semites will assist us thereby in that they will strengthen the persecution and oppression of Jews. The anti-Semites shall be our best friends. Herzl also used the term the final solution of the Jewish question in an 1899 letter to the Russian Tsar. I owe my permission to submit the Zionist plan for the final solution of the Jewish question. The Zionist Nahum Sokolov wrote in his 1919 book History of Zionism that the progress of modern civilization has come to be regarded as some sort of modern messiah for the final solution of the Jewish problem. Richard James Horatio Gothel was the son of a rabbi and the president of the American Federation of Zionists. He said, assimilation of the Jews must not be the final solution of the Jewish question. The Jewish Yearbook of 5676 states that the British Jews adopted a policy for the final solution of the Jewish question. Even in 1940, a Jewish magazine article quoting Trotsky mentioned the final solution of the Jewish question. Israeli lawyer, diplomat, and Zionist Arye Leon Kubovi said, there exists no document signed by Hitler, Himmler, or Heydrich speaking of exterminating the Jews. The word extermination does not appear in the letter from Goering to Heydrich concerning the final solution of the Jewish question. Hitler's main goal was to fix the problems of the Versailles Treaty and to take back the stolen German territory to unite all Germans into the Third Reich. As early as in 1923, Hitler said in his speech, "So long as this treaty stands, there can be no resurrection of the German people. No social reform of any kind is possible." The treaty was made in order to bring 20 million Germans to their deaths and to ruin the German nation. What politically correct historians fail to mention or deliberately cover up is the fact that Hitler actually made several documented attempts in an effort to avoid World War II. However, each of these peace offerings were rejected by those who would gain from a war with Germany. On 17th of May 1933, Hitler delivered a speech declaring that Germany was willing to disarm if the neighboring countries would reciprocate. The proposal was rejected. Instead, the other countries continued filling up their arsenals with weapons, piling up their stores of explosives, and increasing the numbers of their troops. The League of Nations, the globalist instrument of the victorious powers, forced Germany through a period of probation before it would be possible to discuss the disarmament of the other countries. Thus, on October 14, 1933, Hitler broke away from the globalist League of Nations, with which it was impossible to come to any agreement. On 18th of December 1933, Hitler submitted a six-point proposal for the improvement of international relations. On 26th of January 1934, Hitler completed a non-aggression pact with Poland. The danger to the Reich was now so great that Hitler reintroduced conscription on March 16, 1935. On 1st of March 1935, Hitler assured France on every possible occasion of his desire to live at peace with her. On 21st of May 1935, Hitler made another attempt to avoid the growing possibility of war. On 18th of June 1935, Hitler negotiated a naval agreement with Great Britain. On 31st of March 1936, Hitler formulated a comprehensive plan for peace. This peace plan could have been a genuine turning point for the prosperity of all nations in Europe. The Anschluss was the voluntary unification of Austria into the German Reich. The Versailles Treaty had broken up the Austria-Hungarian Empire and denied the new Austria from uniting with Germany. But after seeing the great success of Hitler's Germany, there was no stopping the Austrians' desire to unite with their joyful brothers and sisters. An overwhelming 99% of Austrian citizens voted to reunite with their Germanic brothers. Without a shot being fired, on the morning of 12th of March 1938, German forces crossed the border near Hitler's birthplace of Braunau and were greeted as saviors and liberators by the joyous Austrians. As a brotherly gesture towards the Austrians and a sign to the rest of the world of a peaceful reunion, Hitler invited Austrian troops to march inside of Germany as well. Not surprisingly, the Western globalist media portrayed the joyful unification as Germany invaded and conquered Austria. Austria was still in the Depression when Hitler unified the both countries. With the help of Germany, this problem was turned around, order was restored, and within 2 years, there was full employment.
The German people of Czechoslovakia share the same desire to reunite with Germany. When the Treaty of Versailles ripped Austria-Hungary to pieces, it combined Czechs, Slovaks, Germans, and Hungarians into an artificial state called Czechoslovakia. Prague and Bohemia have been part of Germany for centuries. The Prague regime represented a grave threat to Germany. Czechoslovakia's communist president, Beans, had been ordered by his Kremlin masters to open his borders to the communist armies at a moment's notice to start off a war against Germany. Prague was going to be the Soviet springboard to Germany. The German region Sudetenland, abides south of Germany, had 3.5 million citizens. Just as the Austrians, the Sudetenlanders wished to unite with Germany. But Czechoslovakia's communist president Edvard Beneš would not allow it. The Sudetenlanders were already seriously mistreated by the communist state of Czechoslovakia. To end this, on 15th of March 1939, German troops entered into Czechoslovakia. Later that same day, Hitler was in Prague with his troops. To resolve the matter peacefully, Hitler called for an emergency conference in Munich with Italy, France, and England. All agreed that the German Sudetenland would be unified with Germany, and that the Slovaks would have their own state called Slovak Republic. The Sudeten Germans were returned to German rule just as they wished. Truly a win-win situation.
As when arriving in Austria, Hitler also received a hero's welcome upon visiting the Sudetenland. Chamberlain returned from Munich to a blissful response, waving a paper he and Hitler had signed, and declared, "For the second time in our history, a British Prime Minister has returned from Germany, bringing peace with honor. I believe it is peace for our time." In December 1938, Hitler instructed the German foreign minister to make an agreement with France. After World War I, the Allies had cut up German territory and given part of Germany, Western Prussia, to the newly re-established nation of Poland. Eastern Prussia was totally left cut off and isolated from Germany. The Treaty of Versailles had separated the German city of Danzig from Germany and given it to Poland against the wish of its citizens. Political scientist Stefan Wolf, professor at the University of Birmingham, says that the actions of Polish state officials after the corridor's establishment followed a course of assimilation and oppression. As a result, a large amount of ethnic Germans left Poland after the First World War. The contemporary German statisticians say 592,000 Germans had left by 1921, and other Polish scholars say that up to 1 million Germans left. That Free City of Danzig was over 90% German and had since 1871 belonged to Germany. The city, with a predominantly German-speaking population, along with its surrounding German area of East Prussia, Danzig was isolated from the German mainland by the Versailles Treaty, with formerly German territory now belonging to Poland, cutting right through the Prussian Pomeranian region of Germany.
Contrary to popular belief, Hitler did not hold a grudge against Poles. In fact, he was profoundly impressed by the Polish victory in the Polish-Soviet War 1919-1921. Hitler wanted the kind of alliance with Poland he had with Italy, and if it could, he would have teamed up with the Polish people to defend Europe from communism. Marshal Joseph Piłsudski was the leader of Poland up until his death in 1935. He was idolized by Hitler. In 1934, a peace pact was signed between Adolf Hitler and Piłsudski, ensuring peace between the two nations. It made good sense that Poland should participate in a defense wall against Bolshevism, said Hitler. Every Polish division would mean strengthening the military power against not only a possible, but now already significantly obvious onslaught of Bolshevism against Europe. All anti-Polish propaganda was now banned by Hitler. In a Reichstag speech, May 21, 1935, Hitler said, "We recognize, with the understanding and the heartfelt friendship of true nationalists, the Polish state as the home of a great nationally conscious people." According to this non-aggression pact, both countries pledged to resolve their problems through negotiations, not armed conflict. Unfortunately, Piłsudski died on 12th of May 1935, and peace negotiations fell through. In Germany, flags were now flown half-mast. Hitler was truly saddened by Pilsudski's death, and he even wrote a letter to his wife. The sudden death of the Polish leader was very bad news for Germany. The popular marshal was succeeded by the Marshal Edward Rutz Smigli. Pilsudski's death and Smigli's rise was to be great setbacks for Germany. Smigli was not interested in peace with Germany, and he instead signed the Polish-British Common Defense Pact that promised of British military assistance in a situation if Poland would be attacked by another European country. America's Jewish Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau Jr., telephoned the Jewish-French politician Leon Blum and suggested freezing German bank accounts in France in hopes of pushing France into a war with Germany. On October 1938, Poland's dictator Smigli demanded a portion of Salcie and some other smaller Czech areas. The Polish army annexed the areas with a population of 227,399 people, and Polish tanks rolled into the annexed Czech territory. The Czechs were too powerless to stop the forced annexations. On 16th of March 1939, supposedly neutral Roosevelt sent an ultimatum to Britain demanding that hereafter the British government would strongly oppose Germany. Maps now started to circulate showing a new western Polish border extending to just west of Berlin. German newspapers and politicians like Adolf Hitler now accused Polish authorities of organizing and tolerating violent ethnic cleansing of ethnic Germans living in Poland. On 25th of April 1939, the Jewish diplomat, journalist, and novelist William Bullitt called American newspapers columnist Carl von Weygart, chief European correspondent of the International News Service to the American Embassy in Paris, and told him, "War in Europe has been decided upon. Poland has the assurance of the support of Britain and France, and will yield to no demands from Germany. America will be in the war soon after Britain and France enter it." In a secret conversation at Hyde Park on 28th of May 1939, Roosevelt assured the communist former president of Czechoslovakia, Dr. Edvard Beneš, that America would actively intervene on the side of Britain and France in the anticipated European war. Count Jerzy Potocki was the Polish ambassador to USA. He explained in 1934 that, "Above all, propaganda here is entirely in Jewish hands. When bearing public ignorance in mind, their propaganda is so effective that people have no real knowledge of the true state of affairs in Europe. President Roosevelt has been given power to create huge reserves and armaments for a future war which the Jews are deliberately heading for." In a report from Washington back to the foreign minister in Warsaw, dated 9th of February 1939, he wrote, "The pressure of the Jews on President Roosevelt and on the State Department is becoming ever more powerful. The Jews are right now the leaders in creating a war psychosis, which would plunge the entire world into war and bring about general catastrophe. This mood is becoming more and more apparent. In their definition of democratic states, the Jews have also created real chaos. They have mixed together the idea of democracy and communism, and have above all raised the banner on burning hatred against Nazism. This hatred has become a frenzy. It is propagated everywhere and by every means in theaters, in the cinema, and in the press. The Germans are portrayed as a nation living under the arrogance of Hitler,
which wants to conquer the whole world and drown all humanity in an ocean of blood. In conversations with Jewish press representatives, I have repeatedly come up against the inexorable and convinced view that war is inevitable. This international Jewry exploits every means of propaganda to oppose any tendency towards any kind of consolidation and understanding between nations. In this way, the conviction is growing steadily, but surely, in public opinion here, that the Germans and their satellites in the form of fascism are enemies who must be subdued by the democratic world. In a diary entry of July 6, 1939, he said, "In the West, there were all kinds of elements openly pushing for war. The Jews, the supercapitalists, the arms dealers. Today, they are all ready for a great business because they have found a place which they can set on fire, Danzig, and a nation that is ready to fight, Poland. They want to do business on our backs. They are indifferent to the destruction of our country. Indeed, since everything will have to be rebuilt later on, they can profit from that as well. As before, the Germans in Poland were a persecuted minority, deprived of all rights, just as with the Germans stranded in Czechoslovakia. Between 1919 to 1939, Germany was repeatedly attacked by Polish partisans working for Jewish or communist interests. There were already 80,000 ethnic Germans in refugee camps in both Danzig and the German Reich. Irish defector to Germany, William Joyce, explained, "German men and women were hunted like wild beasts through the streets of Bromberg. When they were caught, they were mutilated and torn to pieces by the Polish mob. Every day, the butchery increased. Thousands of Germans fled from their homes in Poland with nothing more than the clothes that they wore. On the nights of August 25th to August 31st, inclusive, there occurred, besides innumerable attacks on civilians of German blood, 44 perfectly authenticated acts of armed violence against German official persons and property. There were 12,857 identified dead in the Bromberg area, leaving a large number of unidentified dead there, and many more dead elsewhere." Both Hogan and Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau agree with these conclusions. These historical facts were also confirmed by the East German historian Theodor Bierschenk in 1954 and the social democratic journalist Otto Heike in 1955 on the basis of Polish documents. George Ohio said, "I lived in Germany during the 1980s, when many people who lived during the war were still alive. I sought out anyone who lived near Poland in 1939 and was lucky enough to meet several people. One was a customs official who said it was so bad on the border they were armed and also had grenades in their office ready for attacks. Another told me his farm animals were often stolen by Polish terrorists. Another told of his niece being raped by a Pole who crossed the border. This is just one of many stories told to me by German civilians who witnessed these border incursions, just like had happened in 1919 to 1928. One thing many people fail to see is that Poland openly attacked Germany right after World War I, which led to many border battles. Once Germany started pressing Poland to work out a solution to the corridor, the attack started again. And one thing that is clear to me is that Germany did not make up these attacks." To resolve the problems, Hitler made numerous practical proposals, which included the militarization of the key port areas, public referendum, accepting Gdynia as a Polish port city on the Baltic Sea, 1 kilometer wide rail and road passage to link Eastern Prussia to Germany, or to link Poland to the Baltic Sea. The Anti-Comintern Pact would also be signed to protect Poland from communist subversion. Every single German proposal was ignored. The widely disliked Polish Minister of Foreign Affairs, Joseph Beck, refused every single German proposal. After this, German propaganda would turn against Poland.
both Britain and France openly approached Stalin's genocidal Bolshevist regime with the hopes of restoring a new version of the Triple Entente alliance that had created the two-front World War I against Germany. Rydzmigol, the new dictator of Poland, was selected by the globalists to pick a fight with Germany, for Britain and France to then attack Germany from the east in defense of Poland, and finally for the Soviet Union to then join the fight against Germany from the east. This planned aggression strategy towards Germany was being discussed openly and in mainstream media, for example, as early as 1938 in a book titled A New Holy Alliance by well-known Jewish writer Emil Ludwig, born Emil Cohn. In the book, he called for a rebirth of the exact same two-front military alliance that two decades earlier had been plotted against Germany: UK, France, US, Russia. The highly influential globalist New York-based Council on Foreign Relations, in its magazine Foreign Affairs, carried a favorable review for Ludwig's book, in which the possibility of creating a two-front alliance was openly confirmed. Emil Ludwig said, "Even if Hitler at the last moment would want to avoid war, which would destroy him, he will, in spite of his wishes, be compelled to wage war." Hitler saw right through this transparent game and consequently reached out to Stalin. On 23rd of August 1939, Hitler signed the German-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact, also known as the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. This was done to hinder the warmongering Western allies by neutralizing their new Triple Entente with Soviet. Hitler did not want a two-front war, and the temporary alliance with Stalin was done out of hopes that the British would not dare to declare war. Even after the pact was signed, Hitler still tried to avoid any war by reaching out to the Allies for talks, which they refused to engage in every time. Hitler even wrote a heartfelt letter to French President Daladier just days after Ribbentrop and Molotov was a finished deal in Moscow. Already in October 1930, the influential Polish newspaper, the Liga der Großmacht, carried the following declaration: "A struggle between Poland and Germany is inevitable. We must prepare ourselves for it systematically. The defeat of Germany must be produced by Polish troops in the center of the territory in order to strike Germany to the heart. In a war with Germany, there will be no prisoners and there will be no room neither for human feelings nor cultural sentiments. The world will tremble before the German-Polish war. We will evoke in our soldiers a superhuman mood of sacrifice and spirit of merciless revenge and cruelty." The Warsaw newspaper Depesza, on 20th of August 1939, carried out the following message: "We are ready to make a contract with the devil if he helps us fighting against Hitler. Listen, against Germany, not only against Hitler, the German blood will be spilled in a future war in such streams like it wasn't seen since the beginning of the world." Poland's Marshal Rydzmigol said in the Daily Mail, 6th of August 1939, that "Poland wants war with Germany, and Germany will not be able to avoid it, even if she wants to." The Polish ambassador in Paris said on 15th of August 1939, "It will be a Polish army that will invade Germany on the first day of war." Lord Beaverbrook was the top newspaper mogul in Great Britain. His Daily Express was the most read newspaper in the world at the time. In a private letter written in March 1938, he wrote, "There are 20,000 German Jews in England, in the professions, pursuing research. They all work against an accommodation with Germany. The Jews have got a big position in the press here. At least I am shaken. The Jews may drive us into war." Hitler finally declared to British Ambassador Sir Neville Henderson on August 25, 1939, "Poland's provocations have become intolerable." Polish officials were encouraged to attack Germany by the promises of British Ambassador Sir Howard William Kennard and French Ambassador Leo Newell. They had promised that Britain and France would come to Poland's immediate aid if Germany would attack. Hitler mentioned over 30 border violations for August alone in his Reichstag speech on the 1st of September 1939. During the last weeks of August 1939, Germans were openly terrorized in villages with the expression, "Slaughter them off."
Racial propaganda in the Polish, mainly Jewish-owned press, played a major role in the persecution of the ethnic Germans. The attacks reached their climax on September the 3rd in Bromberg, in what is known as the Bloody Sunday. The Polish military gave full support to the Polish civilians and partisans hunting down, slaughtering the remaining German minorities still left in Poland in the standard communist practice. The German population was hunted down, the houses were searched, and ethnic Germans were beaten and raped. They were usually herded together, driven off and massacred in isolated spots, in numbers reaching from 39, 48, 53 to 104 at a time. At least 5,500 were slaughtered like pigs. Children were nailed to barns, women were raped and hacked to death with axes, men were beaten and hacked to death. 328 Germans were herded into Bromberg's Protestant church, after which the church was set on fire. All 328 burned to death. The massacres in the city of Bromberg would be hidden from our history books. Today, these massacres have turned out to be one of the most monstrous and brutal of crimes to ever be inflicted on a civilian population. Leon de Grail said, "Of all the crimes of World War II, one never hears about the wholesale massacres that occurred in Poland just before the war. Thousands of German men, women, and children were massacred in the most horrendous fashion by press-enraged mobs. Hitler decided to halt the slaughter and he rushed to the rescue. Germany finally retaliated on the 1st of September 1939. The same day, Danzig was formally captured by Germany. Germany invaded Poland and reclaimed the territories that had been taken away from her by the Versailles Treaty. The war with Poland lasted just 29 days. The Blitzkrieg had taken Poland by surprise. Acts of violence against the Germans would continue and eventually include a total of 58,000 Germans slaughtered. The mass murders of Germans stopped on 18th of September when German troops arrived at Lowrich.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
Liberated Germans welcomed Hitler to Danzig as a hero. After having blocked the path to any peaceful discussion for 7 years prior to the war, Britain and France declared war on Germany on September the 3rd, 1939. On the 5th of September, the first bomb was dropped on German soil by the Royal Air Force. The Soviet Union then invaded Poland from the east and massacred tens of thousands of innocent Poles, but the Allies said nothing. The Allies only used Poland as a dummy to start the war. Churchill would even give over Poland and the whole of Eastern Europe to Soviet after the war. The French actually invaded Germany on September the 7th. The German army, now reinforced with troops returning from the Polish campaign, conducted a counteroffensive which took back the lost territory from the invading French. In liberating what the French had invaded, the German lost 196 soldiers plus 114 missing and 356 wounded. On September 17, 1939, the German-Polish War was already over. Hitler's mission had already been accomplished. If Great Britain and France would not have declared war, the war would have been stopped right there, and millions of lives would have been saved. However, Britain had plans of a long war, and they did not want peace. The quiet period between the end of the Polish War until May 1940 is called the Phony War. During this period, Germany continued negotiating for peace. British Duke Arthur Wellesley, 5th Duke of Wellington, said, "This declaration of war is the fault of the anti-appeasers and the fucking Jews." During his speech on October 6, 1939, Hitler pleaded for peace once again. He said, "At no time and in no place have I ever acted contrary to British interest. I believe even today that there can only be real peace in Europe and throughout the world if Germany and England come to an understanding." The majority of Poles understood that the Germans were not their real enemies and had no hand in the game whatsoever. The border conflicts were instigated by the Polish or Jewish partisans, encouraged by the Jewish-owned press and the Polish dictator Smigli, working in close cooperation with Roosevelt. A collection of secret Polish documents which fell into German hands when Warsaw was captured in September 1939 clearly established Roosevelt's crucial role in bringing on the Second World War. They also revealed the forces behind Roosevelt which pushed for war. In September 1939, Adolf Hitler said, "Time and time again have I offered friendship and, if necessary, closest cooperation to England. But love cannot be offered from one side only. It must be met with reciprocation by the other side. Germany is not pursuing any interest in the West." In October 1939, Hitler proclaimed in his speech of a new peace proposal to prevent more Europeans being killed in a senseless war. If the Allied powers wanted peace, they would long ago have taken the hand that was stretched out to them. But no, the fate of this plan was the exact same as that of all the other previous appeals made by Hitler. No response. On the 4th of November 1939, Roosevelt and his Jewish advisor Bernard Baruch instead decided to repeal previous neutrality acts to be able to sell arms to warring nations and to soon enter a new war against Germany. The Daily Herald said in December 1939, "Stop talking about peace conditions. Break Germany in pieces." The Allies' plan of invading Norway and Sweden, attacking to cut off Germany's iron ore resources from Sweden by illegally mining Norwegian waters and then occupying the important Norwegian port of Narvik. On 8th of April 1940, Britain violated Norwegian neutrality by mining Norwegian waters. Plans were also made for building a base of operations in Denmark, Germany's neutral neighbor to its north. These Allied plans were called Operation Wilfred and Plan R4. The Norwegian politician named Vidkun Quisling confirmed the existence of these Allied plots. Quisling had served in the military from 1911 until the mid-20s, specializing in Russian affairs. He was stationed in Russia and saw the Bolshevik plague firsthand. In 1929, he returned to Norway and served as a diplomat and later Minister of Defense for two governments. In 1930, he wrote Russia and Ourselves, where he spoke of the dangers of Bolshevism. In 1933, he founded the National Samling, National Unity Party, to save Norway from the threat of communism. On Adolf Hitler's 50th birthday, Quisling sent him a card, thanking him for saving Europe from Bolshevism and Jewish domination. Hitler told Quisling, "After making one proposal after another to the British on the reorganization of Europe, I now find myself forced against my will to fight this war against Britain." Quisling, who was sympathetic to Germany, did not want his country to become a battlefield, so he informed Hitler of the plot to wage war from the two Scandinavian countries. In the early morning on the 9th of April 1940, Germany therefore quickly put Operation Vesterbom into action and came to secure Denmark and then the Norwegian port of Narvik just before the British could place their mines. This was a preventive maneuver against the planned Allied Operation Wilfred and Plan R4. Thus, Hitler prevented the UK from using Norway and Denmark as bases of operation against German shipping. German diplomats calmly assured the leaders of both Scandinavian nations that Germany seeks neither conquest nor interference in their internal affairs. The Germans dropped leaflets over Denmark which explained their actions, condemned anti-German British warmongering and propaganda, and reassured the Danes that Germany would protect their country. Life under limited German occupation went on without any problems for the Scandinavians during the war, and most of the Nordic people were happy that they were protected by the Germans. Hitler's pleas for peace was repeatedly ignored as British and French troops had massed in northern France. Plans were openly discussed to advance eastward upon Germany via Belgium and Holland. As another preemptive act of national self-defense, Germany took the fight to the Allies before the Allies could invade Germany and reinstitute a second Versailles Treaty on her. The armies of Britain and France were no match for the new tactic called Blitzkrieg. To Britain and France, who anticipated fighting in the trenches like they did in the First World War, this new German war machine came as a surprise they could not handle. The Germans quickly seized vital territory and resources, which outflanked and trapped the Allies on the coast of France. Hitler invaded the League of Nations member states of Belgium and the Netherlands for their strategic location and for collaborating with the Allies. The Low Countries' governments were under intense Allied pressure to allow safe passage for the planned Allied attack on the Ruhr region of Germany. The German government later published a 50-page English-language paper called Allied Intrigue in the Low Countries, which was detailing the full extent of their cooperation with the Allies, explaining why the Germans invaded the Low Countries strategically. The Western press and the modern historians have kept these allegations secret from the public ever since. Jewish-owned press, as well as today's history books, instead portray the Blitz as the Nazi conquest of Holland, Belgium, and France. Churchill's colleague Alfred Duff Cooper said, "War to death against all German people." Lord Beaverbrooke wrote to Frank Gannett in December 1938, "The Jews are after Prime Minister Chamberlain. He is being terribly harassed by them. All the Jews are against him. They have got a big position in the press here. I am shaken. The Jews may drive us into war, and their political influence is moving us in that direction." On the 10th of May 1940, Chamberlain resigned and Winston Churchill came to power without the consent of the people. Churchill was born on November 30, 1874, into the aristocracy of Great Britain. He joined the army and wrote popular books about his military adventures. Churchill was a supporter of eugenics and introduced the Mental Deficiency Act that required those with mental disabilities to be confined to institutions for the duration of their lives, though he originally wanted sterilization. He also introduced the People's Budget, which increased taxes on the wealthy in order to fund social programs. He helped set up his country's first minimum wage and pensions for the unemployed. He was behind the National Insurance Act, which provided sickness and unemployment benefits. The same day that he came to power, Churchill invaded the tiny neutral Iceland in the invasion codenamed Operation Fork. Iceland was a neutral country, but that really didn't seem to matter. The occupation would help to secure British control of the Atlantic. The British quickly moved inland, disabling communication networks and securing landing locations. The government of Iceland protested the violation of their neutrality. Icelandic police officers wanted to stop the British invasion, but they later decided not to resist the superior British force. the U.S. intended to use neutral Iceland as a base of naval operations in the North Atlantic. Many men from Iceland instead volunteered to fight for the Waffen-SS. On 24th of May 1940 at Dunkirk, Hitler had the opportunity to capture the entire British army, but chose not to. Instead, he issued the so-called halt order and delayed the attack for 2 days, leaving the British time for a chaotic evacuation from the port of Dunkirk, hoping that the British finally would lay down their weapons and so they could have peace. Almost everyone saw this as a gesture of peace. All heavy artillery, tanks, and armored vehicles were left on the shores of France. German General von Blumentritt said, "With regard to the halt order, Hitler then astonished us by speaking with admiration of the British Empire, of the necessity for its existence, and of the civilization that Britain had brought into the world. He compared the British Empire with the Catholic Church, saying they were both essential elements of stability in the world. He said that all he wanted from Britain was that she should acknowledge Germany's position on the continent. The return of Germany's colonies would be desirable, but not essential. And he would even offer to support Britain with troops if she should be involved in difficulties anywhere." Churchill was now too drunk to deliver speeches himself. So drunk, in fact, that he hired the actor Norman Shelley, who voiced the Winnie the Pooh for the BBC Children's Hour, to impersonate him. He made the most famous radio speeches in 20th century British history, impersonating Churchill, and fooled tens of millions of listeners. After 6 weeks of German blitzkrieg, Paris was Hitler's. Hitler and Field Marshal Pétain made peace. The armistice was signed in the same railway car in which Germany surrendered after World War I. After the delegations were done, Hitler went home to Berlin, where he was welcomed home as a national hero. Life in northern France went on peacefully for the French civilians during the temporary wartime German occupation of 1940-1944. The manners of the German occupiers was impeccable. Many French women even fell in love with German soldiers. That same day, Hitler via a Swedish third party presented Britain with yet another offer of peace. The Germans contacted the British ambassador in Sweden, Victor Malle, through Sweden's Supreme Court judge Ekeberg, who is known to Hitler's legal advisor Ludwig Weissauer. Hitler's new peace proposal was as following. The British Empire retains all its colonies. Germany's position on the continent will not be questioned. All questions concerning the Mediterranean and its French, Belgian, and Dutch colonies are open to discussion. Poland, a Polish state, must exist. The former Czechoslovakian state remain independent but under German protection. Hitler's peace proposal demanded nothing of Great Britain and entails that the states currently occupied by Germany would be deoccupied, as Germany's occupation was only provisional due to the present war situation. But no, Winston Churchill was not interested in making peace. This offer was rejected. Thanks to Churchill, German peace efforts via Sweden also failed. In the afternoon of 25th of May 1940, Giuseppe Bastianini, the Italian ambassador in London, requested a meeting with British Foreign Secretary Lord Halifax to discuss Italy's neutrality and that of Italian mediation between the Allies and Germany. Bastianini revealed that the goal of the Italian Benito Mussolini was to negotiate a settlement that would not merely be an armistice, but would protect European peace for the century. Halifax responded favorably to it and took the idea to the British War Cabinet, where he summarized his meeting with Bastianini and urged his colleagues to consider Italian mediation. Again, Churchill would have none of it, as he was not interested in making peace. Never even once did Churchill consider Mussolini's offer to mediate peace between Britain and Germany. The matter eventually died. Thanks to Churchill, German peace offers via Italy also failed. Instead of accepting any peace offers, Churchill answered with frightening the British people with fear-mongering tales of a coming German gas attack. A month after England evacuated Dunkirk and the Axis victory against France, Hitler extended his hand one final time to end the meaningless bloodshed.
I had the occasion to talk to him without any other company. And I told him we will have the opportunity to attack London when London is covered by fog, and we can fly with everything we have radio, even with the Junkers 52, like we did in Warsaw. And he said, stop it, stop it. I don't want to hear this. The whole attack on England is against my opinion, against my willing. I could stop it. The English population is of such high class, and they are so similar to the Germans, that I hate to fight England.
In June 1940, Hitler dropped peace leaflets over London. In this hour, I feel it to be my duty before my own conscience to appeal once more to reason and common sense in Great Britain as much as elsewhere. I see no reason why this war must go on. I am grieved to think of the sacrifices it will claim. I should like to avert them. Pamphlets and speeches where Hitler offered peace proposal after peace proposals were not enough. Churchill and his Jewish advisors wanted war. Hitler also held close correspondence with Mahatma Gandhi during 1939 to 1940, and they both tried to get the Allied powers to their senses and prevent a war. Gandhi was a sincere friend of Hitler. Both of them were in alignment on many issues. They both were coming from a humanitarian position and recognized the evil force they were up against. Gandhi knew that Hitler would be the last hope for peace in the world. Dear friend, we have no doubt about your bravery or devotion to your fatherland, nor do we believe that you are the monster described by your opponents.
Meine Angebote an England selbst kennen Sie. Ich hatte nur das große Ziel, mit dem britischen Volk eine aufrichtige Freundschaft erreichen zu können.
Adolf Hitler had never desired any war against the United Kingdom and continued sending out generous peace offers. Awaiting a response from Britain, the Germans remained passive. There was even a big peace movement in the summer of 1940 in Britain. Repeated peace rallies took place right outside Churchill's windows.
In those days, demonstrations could march down Downing Street up to number 10 and stand outside Churchill's window and scream and say, "We are tired of your war, we want peace." And it happened. There were repeated demonstrations outside his windows.
Churchill realized that he needed a pretext to destroying Germany. Because Hitler didn't want to initiate any bombing raids on London, there was no other way that Churchill could drag the Americans into the war unless he could provoke Hitler to do it. Churchill explained his intentions to Joe Kennedy, the American ambassador, father of the late president. "I want the Germans to start bombing London as early as possible because this will bring the Americans into the war, and above all, it will put an end to this awkward and inconvenient peace movement that's afoot in my own cabinet and among the British population." It has been proven that it was Churchill, not Hitler, who initiated the bombing of civilians. According to the Geneva Convention, it was a major war crime to bomb civilians, but Churchill deliberately ordered the RAF to do it anyway. The quiet period of the phony war ended on the 11th of May 1940, the day after Churchill became Prime Minister, as he immediately unleashed the aerial warfare on the German cities, starting with Freiburg. The British Royal Air Force was ordered to bomb civilian areas. The following day, he launched his first attacks on transport targets in the German industrial Ruhr Valley, including Cologne. During May, Mönchengladbach, Gelsenkirchen, Hamburg, Bremen, Essen, Duisburg, Düsseldorf, and Hanover were attacked. In June, attacks were made on Dortmund, Mannheim, Frankfurt, and Bochum. On the 3rd of July 1940, British warships attacked French naval units in the North African port city of Oran to not fall into German hands. Churchill had clearly indicated that he did not want peace. Churchill then ordered raids on Berlin, which went on for the next 7 or 10 days.
Hitler didn't respond, not to that first raid, not to the second, not to the third or fourth. Getting angrier and angrier though. September the 4th, Hitler made a famous speech in the Sportpalast, in Berlin's biggest hall, tens of thousands of chosen audience. He made a speech in which he said, this madman in London, he's now trying to provoke us. If we chose to, if he drops 10 tons of bombs, we can go back and drop 100. If he drops 100 tons of bombs on our towns, I can go back and drop 1,000 tons. And I will one day, I will one day. If they come and destroy it, say they can destroy our cities, he said, I will rub out theirs, Ausheidieren, I will rub out their cities. Very famous speech, which is what Churchill was waiting for. Very next day, September the 5th, he orders a mass air raid on Berlin. Finally, on September the 6th, broad daylight that afternoon, the London population could hear the tread of the approaching German bombers coming up the Thames. And that afternoon, September the 6th, 1940, the beginning of the Blitz, 6,000 Londoners were killed and wounded and injured in that air raid. What Churchill wanted. It was the opposite of what Hitler had wanted. Now Churchill had tricked him into the move that he never wanted to make.
As a result of Churchill's deliberate provocation, a furious Hitler finally retaliated and started bombing the docks in London, the east end of London, finally the city of London and the west end on November 6th and 7th, 1940. In September 1940, 7,000 Londoners were killed in the bombing. On 16th of September 1940, on the orders of Winston Churchill, the British unleashed 100,000 of high explosive bombs and 14,000 firebombs in the first deliberate terror bombings of civilian districts of Mannheim. Deputy Führer Rudolf Hess was Hitler's right-hand man and longtime friend. He was Germany's second in command. He was the guy who typed out the dictation for Hitler's Mein Kampf. In 1940, Hitler asked Hess to get in touch with his English friends and tell them, or any voter, that Germany only looked for peace.
He says privately, Rudolf Hess, you've got these aristocratic friends of yours in England you're always talking about. Can't you contact them in some way and tell them that we want nothing from the British, that we just want peace, we want an end to the war? Can't you get this message across to the British people somewhere? You've got these contacts there. But Hitler had said this to Rudolf Hess, you've got these friends in Britain, now you can surely contact them and tell the British that we want nothing.
His offer for peace was the following. Hitler would be prepared to withdraw the troops from France, the Netherlands, Belgium, Poland, and even Czechoslovakia. He also wanted Britain's agreement to have a free hand in the East to defeat communism. He also wanted the former German areas back. In addition, Hitler offered that the German Wehrmacht would protect the British Empire if she ever was threatened by any enemy. In May of 1941, Hess flied a solo mission with his Messerschmitt Bf 110 over Scotland. At a time when Germany was winning the war, he parachuted in, carrying yet another offer of peace to Britain. Hess was fluent in English and attempted to meet up with what he believed to be British peace activists and to link up with the Duke of Hamilton, who Hess had befriended before at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. He wanted to convince his British friend of Germany's sincere desire for peace. Instead, he fell into Churchill's hands and was arrested. Winston Churchill, of course, refused to agree to Hitler's peace deal offered by Hess. Churchill instead imprisoned him for life and ended his desperate peace mission. Churchill refused all peace offers and kept them from the public. Hess was held in solitary confinement for the duration of the war, on Churchill's orders to hide who was the real warmonger of the war. Secret government documents revealed that the British received over 24 offers of peace between 1939 and 1941. Most notably in September 1939, October 1939, July 1940 after the fall of France, January 1941, etc. The peace offers fell on deaf ears, as Churchill would have none of it. He would instead continue doing his utmost to drag the US into the war. The warmongers would find other means of continuing the war.
Ich war allerdings vorher sehr traurig, denn ich habe ja alles getan, um den Krieg zu vermeiden. In diesen Tagen, da hat Sven Hedin ein Buch herausgegeben, in dem er dankenswerterweise mein damals den Engländern übermitteltes Angebot für die Polen wortwörtlich nun zitiert. Ich muss sagen, Ich habe eigentlich ein Frösteln gefühlt, als ich nun dieses Angebot wieder durchgelesen habe. Dann auch aus dem, was ich seitdem nun weiß. Denn wenn damals dieses Angebot angenommen worden wäre, dann wäre wohl Danzig deutsch, aber im Übrigen wäre alles beim Alten geblieben. Wir hätten uns unseren sozialen Aufgaben gewidmet, wir hätten gearbeitet, wir hätten unsere Städte verschönt, wir hätten Wohnkolonien gebaut, wir hätten unsere Straßen in Ordnung gebracht, wir hätten Schulen eingerichtet. Wir hätten einen richtigen nationalsozialistischen Staat aufgebaut. Und nun ist der Kampf gekommen. Ich habe auch hier alles getan, was ein Mensch überhaupt tun konnte, fast zur Selbstentwürdigung, um es zu vermeiden. Ich habe den Engländern Angebot um Angebot gemacht. Ich habe mit ihren Diplomaten hier gesprochen und habe sie beschworen, sie möchten doch Vernunft annehmen. Aber es war nicht zu wollen, sie wollten den Krieg und sie haben auch gar keinen Hehl gemacht. Seit 7 Jahren erklärt Mr. Churchill, ich will keinen Krieg. Ich habe das bedauert, dass Völker gegeneinander kämpfen müssen, die ich so gerne zusammenführen wollte.
Führer Adolf Hitler, warum dürfen wir nicht zurückschlagen? Warum müssen wir uns das bieten lassen? Ich musste jahrelang sie immer wieder zwingen, legal zu sein. Und so ist es auch heute. Ich muss manches Mal monatelang irgendwo zusehen. Glauben Sie nur nicht, dass mir nicht das Herz vom Grimm zerfressen wird, wenn ich von diesen Luftangriffen höre. Sie wissen, ich habe monatelang das nicht getan. Ich habe auf Paris nicht eine Bombe in die Stadt werfen lassen. Ich habe, bevor wir Warschau angriffen, 5-mal die Aufforderung gerichtet nach Ergebung. Es wurde alles abgelehnt. Ich habe gebeten, man soll an die Frauen und die Kinder wenigstens rausschicken. Nicht einmal der Parlamentär wurde empfangen. Es wurde alles abgelehnt. Und erst dann habe ich mich entschlossen, das zu tun, was nach jedem Kriegsrecht statthaft ist. Als die Engländer mir Bombenwürfen anfingen, da habe ich 3,5 Monate gewartet. Da habe ich nichts getan. Wir waren schon stark genug, es zu tun. Ich habe gewartet, in der Meinung, es würde vielleicht doch die Vernunft zurückkehren. Es kam anders. Glauben Sie, heute ist es nicht anders.
Und nun, meine Volksgenossen, die Opfer. Sie sind für den Einzelnen sehr schwer. Die Frau, die ihren Mann verloren hat, sie hat das Höchste verloren, was sie besitzt. Und das Kind, das den Vater verloren, ist gleich nun. Die Mutter, die ihr Kind opferte, oder auch die Frau oder die Geliebte, die den ihren ziehen ließen und ihn nimmer mehr sehen, die haben alle ein großes Opfer gebracht.
Es möge sich jeder Deutsche dessen bewusst sein, dass das Opfer dieser Männer genauso viel wert war, als das Opfer jedes anderen in der Zukunft wert sein wird. Was die Frau an Opfern auf sich nimmt, indem sie der Nation das Kind schenkt, nimmt der Mann an Opfern auf sich, indem er die Nation verteidigt. Für unser deutsches Volk sind im Laufe von vielen Jahrhunderten, ja Jahrtausenden, zahllose Millionen gefallen. Millionen andere haben ihr Blut dafür gegeben.
Ich habe so oft die Hand geboten, es war umsonst. Sie wollten diesen Kampf, sie sollen ihn jetzt haben. Und das deutsche Volk wird diesen Kampf weiter durchführen, bis zu einer ganz klaren Entscheidung. Das deutsche Volk will endlich Frieden haben. Und zwar einen Frieden, der es arbeiten lässt, der nicht gegen internationale Halunke es ermöglicht, andere Völker gegen uns aufzuhetzen. Diese Leute natürlich, für sie ist der Krieg der größte Verdienst. Ich habe keinen Grund, Krieg zu führen, aus irgendwelchen materiellen Interessen. Für uns kann er nur traurig sein. Uns nimmt er die Zeit, dem deutschen Volk und der ganzen Gemeinschaft unendlich viel Arbeit und Arbeitskraft. Ich habe keine Rüstungsaktien in meinem Besitz. Ich verdiene in diesem Kampf nichts. Ich würde glücklich sein, wenn ich wieder arbeiten könnte, so wie ich früher für mein Volk gearbeitet habe. Aber diese internationalen Verbrecher, sie sind zugleich die größten Rüstungsgewinner, die es gibt. Ihnen gehören die ganzen Fabriken. Sie machen die Geschäfte. Es sind sind die gleichen Leute, die wir früher auch in Deutschland hatten.
Ich wünsche nicht den Kampf. Wenn er mir jemals aufgezwungen wird, dann werde ich ihn führen, solange in mir auch nur ein Atemzug lebendig ist. Und ich kann ihn heute führen, weil ich es weiß, dass hinter mir das ganze deutsche Volk steht. Wenn dieser Krieg abgeschlossen sein wird, dann soll in Deutschland ein großes Schaffen beginnen. Dann wird ein großes Schaffen auf unter deutschen Lande ertönen. Dann wird das deutsche Volk die Fabrikation der Kanonen einstellen. Und wird dann beginnen mit den Werken des Friedens unserer neuen Aufbauarbeit für die Millionen Massen.
In 1933, in his first term, President Franklin Roosevelt normalized relations with the communists, and the Soviet Union was granted diplomatic recognition. The Jewish William Christian Bullitt was made the first U.S. ambassador to the government. Bullitt was later reassigned as ambassador to France. The 32nd degree Freemason President Franklin Roosevelt suggested adding the all-seeing eye and the pyramid to the dollar bill. Roosevelt also openly praised communism. Russia is far better off and the world is safer with Russia under communism than under the Tsars. Stalin is a great leader. On the orders of the Federal Reserve System and its private owners, on 5th of April 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Presidential Order 6102, which required all Americans to deliver all gold coins, gold bullion, and gold certificates to their local Federal Reserve Bank. Any violators would be fined up to $10,000, imprisoned up to 10 years, or both, for knowingly violating this order. Since then, every U.S. citizen is in debt from birth and is property of the privately owned Federal Reserve System.
1933, and that was the year in November when Franklin Roosevelt, then in his very first term, recognized the Soviet Union, normalized relations. Well, this was already underway. We already had the infiltration beginning, Soviet-directed, a Communist Party-directed. And what I discovered at a certain point in my research was that in order to perpetuate this alliance, to continue relations with the Soviet Union, which became really an obsession of American governments from that day forward, the American government had to learn to lie to the people, and tell us lies about communism, tell us lies about Stalin, tell us lies about the Soviet Union.
Malcolm Muggeridge arrived in the USSR in 1932. He was one of the very few journalists to report on the real conditions in the countryside. For every article on the famine that appeared, two were published denying its existence. Muggeridge recalls the most influential correspondent in Moscow was Walter Duranty, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times.
Was not only the greatest liar among the journalists in Moscow, but he was the greatest liar of any journalist that I ever met in the 50 years of journalism. And we used to wonder whether, in fact, the authorities hadn't got some kind of hold over him, because he so utterly played their game. When it came to the famine, the great famine in Ukraine, that was when his reporting was particularly disgraceful, because he denied that there was any famine.
The Soviets actually grant Duranty permission to tour Ukraine unchaperoned. He reports in the Times that all talk of famine now is ridiculous. Yet documents from the British Foreign Office reveal that in private conversations at the British Embassy, Duranty said as many as 10 million people had died.
when they were discussing the question of recognizing the Soviet Union, the United States government recognizing the Soviet Union, the articles of Durante were considered as very valuable evidence on the side of recognition.
And I think in some way, this is where we see the rise of double standards. I think we also see the rise eventually of moral relativism, cultural relativism. These ills that we see in our culture today, I think, have their roots in this relationship. And so I would begin with this very beginning, because I think it was that important. November 16, 1933, the day we recognized the Soviet Union. This was very strange given the record of the Bolshevik government coming in terms of body count. In that early, those early revolutionary years, the Soviet, the new Bolshevik secret police, executed without trial more than 1,000 people per month. Later in the 1930s, Stalin was killing tens of thousands of people per month. And yet the United States rushed into alliance, rushed to recognize the Soviet government under Roosevelt during World War II, rushed into this alliance.
Both the British and the American government were heavily infiltrated by communist leading Jews and Soviet infiltrators. The political leaders in both Britain and America were under the controlling influence of a communist fifth column. Both Roosevelt and Churchill had surrounded themselves with Jewish advisors and relied on Jewish money to support their campaigns for office. The Jews therefore had total control of public opinion in both countries.
We later learned, confirmed, after archives opened on the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, we later learned many of these senior officials in the United States government were working for Stalin. They were Soviet agents.
Some of the communist Jews that had infiltrated the U.S. government surrounding Roosevelt included Bernard Baruch, Felix Frankfurter, David Lilienthal, David Niles, Louis Brandeis, Samuel Rosenman, Henry Morgenthau Jr., Benjamin Cohen, Rabbi Stephen Weiss, Francis Perkins, Sidney Hillman, Herbert E. Lehman, Jesse Strauss, Harold Lasky, Charles Wisiansky, Samuel Untermeyer, Edward Flynn, David Dubinsky, Mordecai Ezekiel, Abby Fortas, Isidore Lubin, Harry Dexter White, David Weintraub, Nathan Silvermaster, Harold Glasser, Irving Kaplan, Salman Adler, Benjamin Cardoso, Anna Rosenberg, and numerous others. These communist-leaning Jews basically functioned as the Soviet Union's agents within the American government. As Jewish historian Lucy Davidovich noted, Roosevelt himself brought into his immediate circle more Jews than any other president before or after him. Winston Churchill was not better himself.
Jerome, the mother of Churchill, was Jewish, and this had been reported in a Jerusalem newspaper, I think, a few months ago. And now I'm obviously looking into that, that she had Jewish blood in her maternal line. Very interesting indeed. I don't think Churchill was cognizant of that fact. He never mentioned it. But what is interesting are his links with the Jewish community, which I'll go into in a little bit of detail here. The two basic areas of interest to look at in Churchill's career are the period when he was in the so-called wilderness, when he resigned from Stanley Baldwin's cabinet as a minister, and for the next 10 years until 1939 he was out of office, out of any office at all. He was just a member of parliament. So all he had was his salary as a member of parliament and his rather pitiful earnings as a journalist, and yet somehow he managed to support an enormous country estate, which cost a very large sum of money to support, with all the gardeners and the nurseries and the nurses and the nannies and the cooks and the housekeepers and all the rest of it. He had a private staff of sometimes 20 or 30 people, all supported on his salary as a member of parliament, which was at that time £500 per annum, $750 a year, or $2,000 actually, because at that time I think it was $4 to the pound. How did he do it? Well, the answer is that from 1936 onwards, he was financed by a little secret pressure group called the Focus. You won't find much reference to the focus in the history books, but it certainly existed, and there are several files of Churchill's private papers relating to the focus. The focus was a group of perhaps 30 or 40 leading British industrialists and bankers and former politicians who decided that Churchill was worth keeping afloat, and they funded him. They weren't all Jews. They were primarily Jewish, but there were also left-wing socialists and left-wing conservative members of Parliament who all decided to keep him afloat. In July 1936, the then chairman of the British of the Shell Petroleum Company wrote out a cheque for Churchill of the order of £40,000, which in modern-day money would be probably about $700,000, and gave it to him as a gift. He was Jewish. It was a Jewish gift to Churchill, and the intention was that Churchill, they bought him. He became the Pied Piper from that moment on. And the one who pays the piper calls the tune. If you look at the events as they really happened, until 1936, he hardly gave Germany a passing mention in his speeches and writings. Other things were more important. From 1936 onwards, he began beating the anti-Nazi, anti-German drum. And at that time, there was a great deal of pro-German sentiment in Britain, as witnessed the behavior of the Duke of Windsor, the king. King Edward VIII, who ruled for just less than a year after the death of his father, was very pro-German and pro-Hitler, and actually got on very well with Adolf Hitler when he visited Germany later in 1937. He was forced to abdicate by the same lobby. But it was this lobby which was financing Churchill from 1936 onwards, and which finally maneuvered and engineered his introduction into the cabinet in 1939, and finally his taking over as prime minister in 1940. He fought a war that Britain had no real interest in. And I've repeatedly said this. Any logical perception of World War II now, looking back after 50 years, screams to the high heavens. And we can see quite clearly that we should have said to the Poles in 1939, you've got a problem with the Germans, sort it out yourself. We should have said to the Jews, you've got a problem with the Nazis, sort it out yourself. It's no concern of Britain and the British Empire, we've got other fish to fry. That's what we should have said. Churchill, unfortunately, was beholden to these people, and he had no alternative. So in 1940, when we had a choice put to us, of accepting the very generous peace offer that was put to us, which has been concealed from the history books by the Germans, or of fighting a totally senseless war onwards, Churchill took the wrong turning and bankrupted Britain and ruined the British Empire. I first said this in my book, Churchill's War in 1987, and now five other major historians have said the same thing. This has now become known as the revisionist line of history of the Second World War, and I'm the one who actually opened up that path, making people think the unthinkable, looking at the alternative route that we could have taken in 1940. In 1941, just to end this, it becomes very interesting indeed because the Weizmann papers, which are the papers of Chaim Weizmann, who was the first president of the State of Israel, and he was the leader of the international Zionist movement throughout World War II, the Weizmann archives foolishly or wisely gave me complete access to all the Weizmann correspondence with Churchill. And in the Weizmann archives, all Churchill's correspondence with Weizmann throughout the war years and before the war, and all his notes on his meetings with Churchill. And I'm only going to mention one of those letters here. It's a letter written by Chaim Weizmann, the leader of the Zionist movement, at that time living in the United States, to Winston Churchill in September 1941, 3 months before Pearl Harbor, when Churchill is frantically trying to claw the United States into his war, because that's his only salvation. And Weizmann writes to Churchill a letter which he says, Mr. Prime Minister, unless you grant us what we want, which is the creation of a Jewish army in the Middle East, with our own arsenal and our own weapons and our own uniform and our own flag, unless you grant us what we want, then you are not going to win us over. And let me tell you what we will do if you do grant us what we want. If you grant us our wishes, then we will act on your behalf in the United States. And remember, Mr. Churchill, he writes in this letter, remember, we are the only powerful, unified bloc in the United States which solidly backs the British cause in this war. September 1941. Everybody else is basically isolationist. We are the only ethnic, unified group which solidly backs the British cause. We are the only people who are in the position to bring the United States into this war. We did it in the last war, and we can do it again.
Churchill became the Gentile frontman of this secret group. Communist and Zionist Jews around Churchill included Sir Robert Mund, Sir Robert Valley Cohen, and Bernard Baruch. Both Roosevelt and Churchill became the Gentile frontman in international Jewry's war on Germany. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain told U.S. Ambassador to Britain Joseph P. Kennedy that the America and the world Jews had forced England into the war. The Jewish magazine Sentinel of Chicago, 8th of October 1940, said, "When the National Socialists and their friends cry or whisper that this war is brought about by Jews, they are perfectly right." Churchill left London to meet Roosevelt for a conference in Quebec late in the summer of 1943. A reporter asked if they were planning to offer peace terms to Germany. Churchill quickly replied, "Heavens no, they would accept immediately." Again, in a 1944 letter to his ally, the mass-murdering Bolshevik Joe Stalin, Churchill confirms the undeniable reality of Hitler's generous peace proposals. "We never thought of peace, not even in that year when we were completely isolated and could have made peace without serious detriment to the British Empire, and extensively at your cost. Why should we think of it now, when victory approaches for the three of us?"
Ja, das deutsche Volk war ja damals eine Demokratie vor uns. Und es ist ausgeplündert und ausgeprescht worden. Nein, was heißt für die internationalen Hyänen Demokratie oder autoritärer Staat? Das interessiert die gar nicht. Es interessiert sie nur eines. Ist jemand bereit, sich ausplündern zu lassen? Ja oder nein? Ist jemand dumm genug, dabei stillzuhalten? Ja oder nein? Und wenn eine Demokratie dumm genug ist, dabei stillzuhalten, dann ist sie gut. Und wenn ein autoritärer Staat erklärt, ihr plündert unser Volk nicht aus, weder innen noch außen, dann ist das schlecht.
In diesen Ländern regiert tatsächlich das Kapital. Sie reden von der Freiheit der Presse. In Wirklichkeit hat jede dieser Zeitungen einen Herrn. Und dieser Herr ist in jedem Fall der Geldgeber. Diese Presse moduliert nun die öffentliche Meinung. Diese Parteien unterscheiden sich so wenig voneinander, als sie früher bei uns voneinander unterschieden haben. Sie kennen sie ja, die alten Parteien. Das war immer eines und dasselbe. Nun müsste man doch meinen, dass vor allem in diesen Ländern der Freiheit und des Reichtums ein unerhörtes Wohlleben für das Volk bestehen müsste. Es ist aber umgekehrt. In diesen Ländern der sogenannten Demokratie wird ja überhaupt gar nicht das Volk in den Mittelpunkt der Betrachtung gerückt. Was entscheidend ist, ist ausschließlich die Existenz dieser paar Macher der Demokratie. Das heißt also, die Existenz dieser paar hundert gigantischen Kapitalisten, die im Besitz ihrer ganzen Werke, ihrer ganzen Aktien sind, und die letzten Endes damit diese Völker ausschließlich dirigieren, die breite Masse interessiert sie nicht im Geringsten. Es sind die einzigen, die wirklich als internationale Elemente anzusprechen sind, weil sie überall ihre Geschäfte betätigen können. Es ist eine kleine, wurzellose, internationale Clique, die die Völker gegeneinander hetzt, die nicht will, dass sie zur Ruhe kommen.
Sie können uns unterdrücken! Sie können uns meinetwegen töten, kapitulieren werden wir nicht!
Unser deutsches Volk siegt heile!
Sie haben früher alle gelacht, diese Juden. Sie haben das für einen Spaß gehalten. Ja, sie lachen heute nicht mehr. Sie wissen, es ist ein blutiger Ernst geworden.
Es war das ein Kampf. Besonders aber auch gegen das Volk, das in unserem Land schon fast allmächtig zu sein schien. Der Kampf gegen das Judentum. Eine satanische Macht, die von unserem ganzen Volk Besitz ergriffen hatte. Die alle Schlüsselstellungen des geistigen, intellektuellen Lebens, aber auch des politischen und des wirtschaftlichen, in ihre Hand gebracht hatte. Und das von diesen Schlüsselstellungen aus die ganze Nation überwachte. Eine Macht, die zugleich aber Einfluss besaß denjenigen, wenn notwendig sogar mit dem Gesetz, zu verfolgen, der es unternahm, sich im Kampf gegen diese Macht anzuschließen und der bereit war, Widerstand dem Vordringen dieser Macht entgegenzusetzen. Das allmächtige Judentum hat uns damals den Krieg angesagt. Und wir haben gearbeitet. Was haben wir geschafft in den Jahren bis 1939? In eben dem Maß wuchs wieder der Neid. Der gleichen Männer, die damals bereits Deutschland den Krieg verzogen hatten. Die Herrn Churchill begannen sofort wieder zu hetzen. Die Mr. Eden und dann natürlich den Juden an der Spitze, ein Horbeleisch und wie sie alle heißen. Sie begannen nun ihre Hetze, Jahr für Jahr. Man sagte allerdings, ja, er rüstet. Ja, das habe ich nun immer getan. Man hat mir früher auch gesagt, warum haben Sie denn dann eine SA, wenn Sie den Frieden wollen? Warum machen Sie sich denn dann eine SS, wenn Sie sowieso nur die Brüderlichkeit wollen? Weil es Leute gibt, die das nicht wollen. Und denen wollte ich zeigen, dass sie auch für den anderen Fall gerüstet sind.
Niemals ermüden und niemals versagen und niemals versagen.